Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
We have the great opportunity to talk about one of the great innovators of the NFL and all of football, Paul Brown, with writer Jonathan Knight, who's an Ohio sports writer and author of 10 books on Cleveland sports. We have Paul Brown's story with Jonathan coming up in just a moment.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at SportsHistoryNetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com, and we are truly privileged in this edition of the Pigskin Dispatch's Game Changer series to talk to an Ohio sports writer and author of 10 books on Cleveland sports, Jonathan Knight. In particular, we're going to be talking about one of his books, Paul Brown's Ghost, and talk about the legendary coach of Paul Brown. Let's bring him in right now. Jonathan Knight, welcome to the Pigpen.
Oh, thanks, Darren. It's great to be here.
Jonathan, this is truly some intriguing notions that you have about Coach Paul Brown and some of the history that you have on him. And we'll get to that in a moment. But I'm also intrigued by your sports writing and some of your other writing that you've done. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Well, like you said, I've written 10 books on primarily in Cleveland sports. They run a little bit of a range, but hitting basically all of Cleveland's teams. Paul Brown's Ghost is the most recent of them. I've also written The Making of Major League, which goes into the making of the classic baseball film that Cleveland just adores. That was a lot of fun to do. But
I think everybody enjoys that movie. That's a great movie.
Yes. Yeah, that's for sure. It was something I didn't even really realize growing up as an Indians fan. I thought that was just for us, and then met more people outside of the world or from other parts of the world. And we're like, oh, wow. Yeah, it's not just us. Everybody loves that. So that was a lot of fun to do. Written several books on the Browns, several on the Indians. So it's kind of run the gamut over the last, almost 20 years now. So it's been a lot of fun. And this latest one was one of the more quirkier projects that I've taken on.
Yeah, the concept of your book is very, very interesting to the readers. Maybe you could explain the title, Paul Brown's Ghost.
Yeah, so it's basically what struck me in the years following Paul Brown's passing in 1991, really by the time we got into probably the 2010s, it started to become very apparent that the Browns and the Bengals were nothing of what they used to be. And it didn't take long to kind of pinpoint, like, gosh, there really is kind of a line in the sand where things started to go downhill very quickly for both of these franchises. And it, coincidentally or not, happened to be right about the time that Paul Brown died. And it didn't take long also, knowing the history of these two teams and sort of the relationship that they've had, in some ways, not even a rivalry. They're very much like stepbrothers. That also ties back to Paul Brown, that you could take that next step and say, gosh, what is this? There's a lot going on here. It's sort of another layer to something like the Curse of the Bambino or the Billy Goat or something, where, okay, that's one team that's being cursed or jinxed or whatever you want to call it. This is two that are connected by the same man. And when that man left this world, both teams seems to have lost their souls in a way. And so that's sort of what the book does, is dives into that, first exploring that relationship between these two teams, how very closely related they are in ways that even long-term fans don't even realize today. And then what happened truly to these teams, these once proud franchises, very, very quickly once Paul Brown died.
Well, you know, that's I'd like to get into that a little bit, but I guess maybe before we do that, maybe we better talk about, you know, Paul Brown and sort of his life path of football. Maybe if you could go into that a little bit, how he's maybe where he started in his football journey.
Yeah, he's and like you said at the top, Paul Brown is the pick your metaphor, the George Washington pro football, the Henry Ford of pro football, whatever you want to call it. He's exactly that. I mean, when you speaking of demarcation lines, you talk about a moment that the NFL became what we know today was pretty much the moment that Paul Brown got involved with it. He turned the game into the clinical precision machine that we see today in terms of preparation, in terms of practice, in terms of intelligence and thought. And prior to Paul Brown coming into professional football in the mid 40s after World War II, it was very, very different. It was very sloppy, very messy, very much the Wild West. It was just nothing like what we see today. And it took some time for it to really settle in and for Paul Brown's influence to carry through the entire league. But boy, when he came into the league, initially coming into pro football in the All-America Football Conference in 1946 with the founding of the Browns, and then after 4 years, the Browns were absorbed into the NFL and continued to be just as dominant there. That's the point where you start to see, gosh, look at what he's doing, how it's just leaps and bounds ahead of what the rest of the league is doing and where the rest of these coaches are. And over the next 10 to 15 to 20 years, you see, oh, now everybody's doing this. And now the NFL has turned into this corporate behemoth that basically owns a day of the week, 6 months of the year. And a lot of that can be traced back to Paul Brown and his career as a coach. And then even after he was unceremoniously fired from the Browns in the early 60s, could have called it a career, could have said, well, you know, that's one Hall of Fame career. I've done everything I can do. I've won championships. I founded teams. I've done it all. He wasn't done yet. He went in and founded the Cincinnati Bengals and owned that team, coached that team for its initial first few years, and then remained on as owner until his death about 20 years later. And there again, just not quite as dominant as the Browns were when they first came in, but the Bengals were for a long time, you know, the cream of the crop in several years there in the 70s and well into the 80s. And that's just really incredible. It speaks so much to what a genius in some ways that Paul Brown was, how he was able to kind of see into the future, bring the future into the present in some ways, and rise the entire level of the league that he was a part of up to his expectations and what he thought the game could be.
You know, I find it fascinating, and Paul Brown's name has really come up a lot lately on Pigskin Dispatch. We cover history. You know, we go back to the rugby days in the 1860s, all the way up to today's football, college, high school, professional levels. And we had a guest on a couple weeks ago, George Bozica, who we were talking about the Massillon Camp McKinley rivalry of high school in the area. And I had not realized until George had educated us on it, that Paul Brown not only coached at Massillon, but he played there before he went on to Ohio State. So it's just his history is very deep in many different areas of Ohio football. And it's amazing.
Yeah, particularly in Ohio. You're exactly right. Like it's that he basically was a legend at all of the major three levels of football in Ohio. Mm-hmm. He went from Massillon and built the first real power in high school football, national power, like people across the country in the 1930s, they were so good that people knew of this team across the United States and knew of Paul Brown, and then kind of parlayed that into the job at Ohio State, and Ohio State led them to a national championship. Like, how often do you see that happen? Not very often. Can you jump from high school to college, even back then? And one of the great what ifs, at least in Ohio football history, is what would have happened had Paul Brown remained at Ohio State. That was interrupted by World War II. He joined the Navy. He was in the Navy for a while there. And when he came back, things were a little different. Or when he was about to, as the war was winding down, he kind of expected, I'll go back to Ohio State and pick up where I left off. Well, things had changed. There were some political things behind the scenes. It didn't quite happen. He opted then to go into professional football and go into that path. But it's interesting to consider, well, what would have happened? What if he'd have gone to Ohio State? Would we have ever heard of Woody Hayes? Would Ohio State football be just as successful, more successful? Would it have been different? It's an interesting thing to consider, but yes, absolutely. He is Mr. Ohio football, to be sure.
Yeah, another question. What would have happened to professional football? Because he's definitely probably most of his influence was on the professional game. Even though, you know, George Bozica claims that Maslin won a national championship. They were crowned the national championships in high school. So he won championships in two different professional leagues, the college level and the high school level. I mean, anybody can say that except for Paul Brown. His name's the only one associated with that.
Not a bad career.
Yeah, that's pretty stellar, actually.
Yeah.
So let's go into his 4 years in the AAFC, the All-American Football Conference. And why were the Browns and Paul Brown so successful, do you think, in the AAFC?
I think exactly for all the reasons we just said, he was just so ahead of his time in so many ways. And it became a greater contrast there in the AAFC, because that was obviously an organization that was nowhere near as talented or organized as the NFL, which even at that time, the NFL was not what it would become. But Paul Brown, one of the initial things that set them apart was that he, in the couple of years leading up to the actual beginning of play of the new league, he started putting his team together. And because of that vast experience that he'd had in as a high school coach and at Ohio State, he was able to kind of fish this pool of talent that he had either coached before or coached against, and was able to put out feelers and put a super, super team together. This was, again, not terribly well organized. The teams just, there was no draft, nothing like that. Teams just kind of put together, grabbed whatever players they could put together, cobbled together a roster from who they knew or who they were connected with. And Paul Brown was able to do that. And he's able to sign guys. One of the great stories was Lou Groza signed his professional contract on a battleship. Like, he was still in the service, but Paul Brown was looking forward and saying, oh, well, in a year, we're going to be playing. I'm going to get these guys while they're still in the military before anybody else can get to them. So you end up with a Lou Groza, an Otto Graham, a Bill Willis, guys like this that he had known and played against. And so he was so wise at seeing talent, recognizing talent, that he knew what he wanted to get, and he went and got it. And then once he had that great talent, once that team was ready to take the field, he had that precision, that organization, that turning football into a class, in essence. Like, his players were his students. You would sit and watch film and study film and draw up plays and learn them and memorize them and take tests. It was very, very academic. That had never happened before. And so the sum result of all of this is when that team took the field, that talented, that well-prepared, they just smoked down everything in their path. And in the 4 years that they played in the AAFC, they lost a total of 4 games. I mean, that's ridiculous. That's clearly, that's like, you're on another level. Like, this is inappropriate. So, but then they move on to the NFL, win the NFL title their very first year. So clearly he had it figured out. He knew what he was doing at that point, and he was just on another level that I don't think we've ever seen. As many great coaches as there are today, as there have been through the years, I don't think there's ever been a coach that was so much better than the talent around him, or than the competition around him, than Paul Brown in that era.
You know, you have to sit and wonder what the NFL teams, you know, in 1950, when they absorbed three of the teams from the AFC as it dissolved, you know, the Browns being one of them. The other NFL teams, sort of, when they saw them on their schedule, had to sort of been licking their chops, because the AFC, I have to imagine, had to be like the ugly stepsister or something of the NFL, you know, just an inferior league. And then you have this team come in and, clean your clocks and take your championship in their first year. Goes right to the man at the head, and it has to be Paul Brown.
Yeah. And that's one of the great stories too. The very first game that the Browns played in the NFL, they played the Philadelphia Eagles in 1950. The Eagles had won the previous two NFL titles and were, you know, the greatest team in pro football at that time. And that was exactly their attitude. They're like, oh, well, who are these guys? We're playing this minor league team on opening night. Do we even need to put shoulder pads on? Like, we'll win this. The Browns went out onto their field in Philadelphia and won 35-10. I mean, just smoked them, and sent a message right away. It's like, guys, this is not a minor league team. These guys are for real. We've just seen a sea change in the leadership in the NFL in one night.
And then the Browns, they made it to other NFL championships soon after that 1950, I believe, too, didn't they?
They were competitive. They did. They made it to the NFL title game in their first 6 seasons in the NFL, which is amazing.
So that's 10 straight seasons, if you count the AFC, that they were in a championship game of the league they were playing in.
Yeah, that's incredible. I mean, that will never be matched. We will never see anything like that again.
No, we thought it was amazing in the Buffalo Bills of the 90s or the, you know, the Patriots, you know, recently, but they, you know, not consecutively, 10 years. That's just crazy. Yeah. That's crazy numbers.
Yeah.
So quite a testament to the organization of Paul Brown. Now, he had a lot of different innovations. You alluded to a couple of them. Maybe you could touch on some of those things, what he brought in the NFL that didn't exist prior to his adopting them.
Yeah, and it's interesting because pro football, what's interesting, as I'm sure you and your listeners know through the history of the game, that football in general has very strong roots back to the beginning of the 20th century, but primarily in college. And it was the college game was much more popular, and that had very strong roots in certain areas. And there was a pro game ever since 1920 when the NFL was founded, but it didn't really take root. It didn't really start to find an audience until at least after the war. And even then, not really until television came along and turned it into something in the late 50s, early 60s. So that being said, the pro game prior to Paul Brown coming along, prior to World War II, was very much just like, yeah, there's no real sense of we're going to try and prepare for the next game. We're just going to show up. We're going to muscle things out. It was very, very undisciplined. It was very much like, well, we'll put a team together and we'll roll a ball out there and see what we can do. Now they were, you know, it was a business and they were attracting fans, all of that, but it just wasn't taken with the same level of seriousness that even college football was at the time. So it's ironic then that what Paul Brown really brought to that game was sort of this academic feel that made pro football kind of feel like college in a way, like teaching these players how to do drills the right way, having them sit literally at desks and take aptitude tests, who sit at desks and watch film and chart plays and memorize a playbook, all of these things. He wanted guys who were smart, as much as he needed them to be strong and fast and all of the physical attributes of that are required for the game. He wanted to see how smart they were. And that was unheard of at the time. And it paid off. I mean, once you get a smart player on the field, especially in a key position, like that can make up for physical, any kind of physical disadvantage that might actually exist. So a great example of that is Otto Graham. You know, speaking of guys that he knew and was able to put together, Otto Graham had been a great college quarterback at Northwestern. Paul Brown had coached against him when he was at Ohio State and said, oh, this is who I want. Otto Graham, not only did Paul Brown go to 10 straight championship games, Otto Graham, every single year of his professional football career, he played in the championship game. I mean, he was the Tom Brady of his time, you know, in a way. And that's what you got. You got a guy who had gone to Northwestern, a fantastic school, a super smart guy who was able to bring that kind of leadership and intelligence onto the field. That was a Paul Brown type of player. And we really didn't see that type of player before. Of course, there had been smart guys who had played. There's not to say that football players were Neanderthals prior to this, but that was something that was really a high value was put on guys who were smart, guys who could think, guys who their most important muscle was their brain. And that really had just not been a priority in football prior to that.
Now that brings up kind of an interesting point, because I don't recall, maybe you can correct me, but I don't recall him getting a lot of different free, what we call today free agents from other teams or trades from other NFL teams. I know he brought some in from some of the dissolved AAFC teams, but maybe could that be he was afraid maybe they wouldn't buy into his system because they've adopted some of those practices of being, you know, unruly and unorganized and, you know, just get ready, like you said, you know, roll out of bed and ready to play the game instead of the preparedness and the testing and everything that he did.
It certainly could have been a factor. It definitely later on in his career, that was something that people did hear about Paul Brown as he kind of, particularly in his last few years in Cleveland, you heard that the game had passed Paul Brown by was what many people had kind of suggested, in that he didn't know how to relate to the modern player. And by modern, we're talking late 50s, early 60s here, right? That they didn't necessarily buy into his kind of dictatorial system of we're doing it this way. I don't care how you've done it before. I don't want to hear feedback. This is how we're doing it. This is how we've always done it. that's the end of the discussion. So that certainly later, and not just for Paul Brown, but for a lot of old school guys, that's kind of the crack you hear. And even now, like when coaches are around and they've been coaching in the same place for 5-10 years or been in the league for 15 or 20 years, you start to hear this, well, they're out of touch. They can't really relate with what's going on. They're still old fashioned, all of these things. So yeah, I mean, it was very different when Paul Brown did put that team together. It was very much that initial Browns team was basically in air quotes free agency. It was with no draft and no real league that was in existence that you could put trades together. He just kind of put the whole thing together then. Now, once that team was established, and especially once it got into the NFL, there was no sense of, okay, you know, guys are changing teams every 2 years the way they do now. Once you had your core team together, you had that core team for 5 or 10 years. And guys, you could replace guys or move guys out who did or did not adapt to your system. So that was much better suited for him. Where he really started to have some problems much later in his career, primarily as an owner, is when free agency did start to become more of a factor. And then he didn't really understand why a player would want to leave, or a coach even. He had some problems with hanging on to good assistant coaches or even head coaches. Like, he was just very much, this is how it is, and was very inflexible in that. So it eventually did kind of catch up, but certainly for that time and that era, it worked brilliantly.
Now, you talk about some of those coaches that coached under him, or even players that went on to coach. He has quite the impressive coaching tree that came out of his system. And maybe if you could discuss some of those players and some of those coaches that came out of his system.
Yeah, I mean, it's truly amazing. At this point, we're sort of in some ways, we're in the like second or third generation of that tree, mm-hmm. and like trees off of trees. But yeah, that initial wave, if you look at like his initial assistants, some of those early players that played for him, you're talking about, you know, Chuck Knoll and Don Shula come to mind right away, like probably the two of the most dominant coaches of the 1970s and even the 1980s, both played for Paul Brown. And certainly that was very formative for them and as they turned into coaches. Weeb Eubank came up through Paul Brown, through that system. And then well into the 60s, obviously Blanton Collier, the man who replaced him. And then even when you go on to his career in Cincinnati, in some ways more so, because there you get the infamous Bill Walsh connection. Bill Walsh was a brilliant offensive coordinator for the Bengals in the early 70s, when the Bengals really truly were a title contender in those early years, had some excellent, excellent teams. And a lot of that was, as much as Paul Brown still had some mojo as a coach, a lot of it was because he put together a terrific coaching staff, and Bill Walsh was right at the top of that. And one of the things that actually the book does go into is that Bill Walsh, by all rights, should have replaced Paul Brown as head coach of the Bengals. When Paul Brown decided to step down after the 1975 season, most people assumed, well, Bill Walsh has earned this. The story is that Paul Brown had kind of told him for years, yeah, this is when I retire, you're going to get the job, to keep him from leaving to take a job somewhere else. And Bill Walsh hung around. So when the time finally came, though, Paul Brown didn't give it to Bill Walsh. And Bill Walsh very quickly left and went on through Stanford, and then eventually wound up with the 49ers, wound up beating Paul Brown twice in the Super Bowl in the 1980s, and one of the great what ifs and great regrets of Cincinnati Bengal history there.
Now, is that part of the whole Walsh thing? Is that part of the jinx that you talk about in your book?
That's one of them. Yeah, there's several nuances to it, but one of them is, and like I said before, like some of the kind of crustier things that Paul Brown would do, as much as he was a genius and he was right most of the time, there were still some things that he did that, like, ooh, yeah, those were not some great decisions. So, for example, letting Bill Walsh go. Another less known example, after the Bengals did turn into a Super Bowl team and went to their first Super Bowl in the early 1980s, they were one of the elite teams in the NFL at that point and were kind of set up to be a dominant force throughout the 1980s. One of the key components of that team was their offensive coordinator, Lindy Infante. Lindy Infante got an offer to go coach in the USFL, which was still rolling at that time, or just kind of rising at that time. And one of the great mistakes that Paul Brown made there as well was, okay, well, then you're gone. Like, he could have, Lindy Infante offered to stay one more year because the USFL was playing in the summer, in the spring and summer, not the fall. He could have stayed one more year in that kind of golden era for the Bengals in the 80s. And they could have made one more run at a Super Bowl with the talent that they had. And Paul Brown's like, nope, you're gone. If you're not going to be here full time, I don't want you for one more year. And so he's like, okay, good, fine. He's gone. The Bengals then collapsed, and it took them three or four more years before they could turn back into a contender. The irony, the epilogue to that story is that once the USFL folded and Lindy Infante was out of a job a few years later, the Cleveland Browns hired him as their offensive coordinator, and he turned that offense into a Super Bowl contender. So these things, there's these little wavelengths and these nice little parallels and connections between the teams throughout the history that are kind of fun to look back on.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like that. You know, so there's more shared just between, the direct connection to Paul Brown and, you know, sort of their color schemes are similar and everything, mm-hmm. and being in the same state. Yeah. But yeah, there's quite a few things. I'm in Western Pennsylvania. I'm in Erie. So I'm right over the line from Ohio. And of course, I'm a Steelers fan over here. And we're quite familiar with both the Bengals and the Browns organizations throughout the year.
For sure.
But very, very interesting indeed. Now, what do you think were, besides the public perception that Paul Brown was sort of losing track of the game when he was in Cleveland, do you think, is that the real reason why he was let go? Was it Modell that was the owner at that time?
Yeah, it was Modell. Modell had just come in, and it's a complicated story that we still to this day, we don't know exactly what went down, what the motivation exactly was. There are two versions of the story. One is that Paul Brown quit. One is that Art Modell fired him. We still don't know. They're, you know, for the rest of both of their lives, neither one of them really clarified or agreed on an actual version of what happened. But in essence, Art Modell came in and bought the team in 1961. He was this relatively young, slick ad executive from New York, and he was looking to make his mark. He was very vivacious and was very much a self-promoter, and came in, and it's whatever version of the story you adhere to, it's difficult not to see that, well, okay, there was not going to be room for Art Modell and Paul Brown in the same franchise. There just wasn't. There could only be one face of the franchise. There could only be one giant ego on this franchise. And they were not going to be copacetic. They were not going to be able to coexist there. So Art Modell just kind of realized, well, this is my team. I'm not going to be second fiddle to Paul Brown. And under the veil of, well, the team has slumped, the team is not as dominant as it was, it is clearly not the powerhouse that was running off championships 10 years ago. The team has apparently lost faith. The players don't believe in the system. He's gone. And that was sort of the justification of it. It's difficult to, in some ways you can kind of see it, because the Browns do 2 years later under Blanton Collier do win an NFL title that they had not won for 9 years under Paul Brown. So in that sense, you can say, well, maybe that's true. And the team was, Jim Brown, for instance, turned in his best years after Paul Brown had been fired. So there is evidence to suggest that, yeah, Paul Brown may have, if not necessarily lost touch, he might've been a little too entrenched, a little not quite open enough to new ideas. But then again, he comes back about 10 years later with the Bengals. And in those first few years, as when he was the head coach, the Bengals turned into a very fine team. They won the division their very first year in the NFL. They made the playoffs a few years after that. Probably should have gone a little farther than they did. Kind of had a couple of bad breaks there. But like, clearly he hadn't lost his mojo. Some of that was, like I said before, he put together a great coaching staff that went on to be head coaches elsewhere, but that takes wisdom too. So it's hard to say that Paul Brown was totally out of touch at the time that he was fired, but that probably the time for a change had arrived at that point in the early 60s.
Okay. Now maybe you could, I guess, first of all, share where we could get a copy of your book, Paul Brown's Ghost. If it's online or where the best place to get it?
Yeah, you can get anywhere. You can get it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, anywhere online. If you're still going to physical bookstores, I believe you can find it at most Barnes & Nobles or smaller shops or be able to order it. But as always, Amazon is probably your best bet.
Okay. And I'm guessing, since you've already wrote 10 books on Cleveland sports, that I'm sure you probably have something in the works. Maybe you could give us a little tease on to know what to expect.
In some ways, yes, it's not, I'm venturing outside of the sports world a little bit. So I'm working on some, a couple projects that, they're a little bit different that are still kind of taking shape. So, the next time we're on, we'll have to figure that out. They're still kind of, we're seeing okay. Where we land.
But, okay.
Yeah. It's kind of going into a new venture.
Okay. Well, fair enough. Well, Jonathan Knight, I appreciate you coming on here and talking about your book, Paul Brown's Ghost. We will have links for on pigskindispatch.com where you can get it from, and also in the show notes of this podcast. And Jonathan, we thank you once again for sharing your story of Paul Brown with us today.
Absolutely. Anytime. Thank you.
Peeking up at the clock, the time's running down. We're going to go into victory formation, take a knee, and let this baby run out. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you back tomorrow for the next podcast. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. A special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hey there, football fans. This is Ross, the host of the Pigskin Tales podcast. I just need a few moments of your time to talk about the host of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, Darren Hayes. He's expanded the Pigpen to search out information on the history of all team sports. It's a quest to find out about the competitors, teams, and places chronicled throughout athletic history through the uniforms and gear the participants used and wore. And he is taking you, the listener, with him on this educational journey to preserve sports history on the Sports Jersey Dispatch, found here on the Sports History Network. His newest podcast, called Jersey Dispatch, is all based on the jerseys that all the greats used to wear. You can find Darren Hayes and the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, as well as Jersey Dispatch, on your favorite podcast provider multiple times each week. So remember that Darren Hayes, the host of the Pigskin Dispatch and Jersey Dispatch podcasts, is found right here on the Sports History Network.